And of course, Nick Pister with us. We're talking with him about his work, The Axe Murders of Saxtown. Grisly story. And we're going to be back in a moment. We'll take your calls and continue talking about the curses on Coast to Coast. Welcome back to Coast, Nick Pister with us. His work, The Axe Murders of Saxtown. Did you enjoy yourself writing this book, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, it was a long process. It took 10 years, actually, from when I started researching it after my experience with Father Cleary. I started looking at a lot of the newspaper articles about it. The one complicating factor is that many of the newspaper articles that were written back then were in German. I remember going up to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library in Springfield, and I found the articles, and I put them on the microfilm machine, and I looked at them, and I was really excited to have found them, and then I realized I had no idea what I was looking for because I don't speak a word of German. I got them translated by a woman in California in the wine country. Her name's Anne Rose Romer, and she did a fantastic job, and it really brought the story to life, and she really tried to, you know, she was writing notes in the margin, trying to help solve the case, trying to do all sorts of things. And that part I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed the research and looking at all these things. One complicating factor in addition to the other was that the case file of this murder mystery was stolen in the 1890s. So that doesn't exist. I didn't have that grand jury reports and investigative files to really go back and look at. So I was really at the whim of newspaper articles and everything I could find. I found some civil court files because all the neighbors turned against each other and they started suing each other for slander, for saying, accusing each other of the murders. So it really turned into this crazy affair amongst them for decades after the murders.
So, but we got to meet at the Cafe Napoli in Clayton when I get back.
Yeah, definitely. I'd love to do that.
I'll be back in about a month or so. And I was reading your bio, so it says that you live downtown. I'm guessing you live in the loft area on Washington Avenue.
Yeah, well, I live near there. I actually live in a building called the Missouri, it's called the Park Pacific, and it was the former headquarters of the Missouri Southern Railroad.
Oh, sure. Oh,
and, well, yeah. And Union Pacific was there as well, and it's a beautiful Art Deco building, and they just redid it, and it's got about 230 units in it, and it overlooks St. Louis City Hall, and it has a great view of the skyline.
It is a great city.
It is, and I think it's underrated. I think one thing that people forget about St. Louis is that it was at the epicenter of so many things in our culture and in our technology, and it also just has a lot to offer people and often gets overlooked on the East and West Coast.
You cover the story of Ray Vincent. I know Ray real well, and you probably helped him with your investigation.
Yeah, I you know,
that was a bizarre case.
That was a really crazy case, and it actually turned up for, you know, for people who aren't familiar with it. He was a mortgage lender, very well known in the St. Louis area, and he had a very high profile divorce from his wife. She ended up getting the lion's share of his net worth because she showed to a judge that he had an affair and was doing all sorts of crazy things. But it turns out that her bodyguard and her private investigator actually coerced a lot of the testimony. In fact, they went to the point of getting Heidi Fleiss to get a...
yeah, they made it all up, didn't they?
Yeah, they got this prostitute to basically make up that she had an affair with this guy. They went and coached her testimony before a judge, and she ended up getting the lion's share of the money, and Ray ended up getting very little of it, and it was a horrible situation, and nobody really believed him. And I started looking through all these documents about the case, and he ended up going to a case in Nevada and, you know, suing them, and basically was able to show and prove that there was this conspiracy to, you know, get most of his money.
Yeah, I've got a story that... you should break. I'll probably call you after you're off the air tonight with me, Nick. I'll give you a couple things that you're probably aware of the story, but you might not know some of the inside stuff that my sources have told me. You would do a much better job with it because it's something we generally just don't handle on this kind of a show. But I'm gonna give you some inside info on something you can run with. See, you get stories just by being on the air with us.
That helps. I'm glad to be here. I'm really excited.
Now, let's go get back to the axe murders and the curses. Why did they think there was a curse there? Because they even thought that there was a curse before anything had happened, right?
Yeah. The family that this happened felt that, particularly the elder man, he came over from Germany. And in Germany, times were so tough. They had no land. They had nothing. He was trying to do the best he could. He was not prosperous. His house burnt down. They don't know who burned it down. They think somebody did it. And then he rebuilds the house, and then lightning strikes it, and it's burned down again. Four of his five children die at childbirth. It just feels like God has something in store for him. It's almost, the beginning of the book almost unfolds like the book of Job. You know, all these bad things keep happening to him. So he comes to America, and he still thinks that God or someone is going to punish him. And yet he finds prosperity. He gets a farm in Illinois, and things start going well. But he thinks that something will happen. His wife dies, and he ends up having a son, and the one remaining son that he had made it through childbirth, and things appeared to be okay. But you know how sometimes people are always afraid that when something good happens to them, that it'll be followed by something bad.
Yeah.
That's what this guy had, and he became an alcoholic and was basically fretting that something around the corner was going to happen, and it did.
Is that farm still haunted to this day?
Well, that's what people say. I've interviewed a number of people, and since the book came out on Tuesday, I've actually heard from some people who've lived out there at different times. The original barn where the family, that they had built themselves, and you can go out there and see it, and it's made of all wood, even the nails are wood. That still stands on the property. The house where the murders occurred was torn down in the 1950s.
I would hope so.
But people still lived in there up until the 1950s, and that's when the idea of ghosts and people seeing stuff started happening. The house actually, in that form until the 1950s, had misguided swings of an axe in the walls and in the door jamb and in the doorway. Like that, people lived in there with that. You know, the blood stains, they could get out of the wood. I mean, they were basically still living in a crime scene for 50 years after the murder. The guy who owned the house in the 1950s said he was tired of people walking and driving by, pointing at it, calling it that murder house. They tore it down. He built a new house over it, over the original foundation. But people who lived in it subsequently, in fact, a man who owns the property now, he built himself a new house nearby, but he still owns the property, and he rents out the house that was built over the original foundation. He lived in there for a period of time, and he always, felt when like the anniversary of the murders would come up, that one morning he was with his wife and he hears somebody pounding at the door. He hears a dog barking. There's no dog out there. There's nobody at the door. This is a remote area. That sort of thing started happening to other people who lived in that house, that they felt someone was inside of that house or that people were somehow out there. I've heard from people who have seen or report to have seen images, like ghostly images of children on the highway, and they think maybe it's the young murdered family children, that maybe this family is still out there, that they haven't gone to wherever they're supposed to be because their crime, their murder hasn't been avenged in any way, that this is an unsolved case. And that exists all the time. And like the man who owns the property said, he would always hear a dog barking, particularly around the anniversary of the murders. The family, as we know, had a dog, and it was penned up, and it was a critical factor in this case. Perhaps they think maybe that is that dog somehow howling in the distance.
Well, there's no question, I think, even if you knock a house down, I think, the ground itself probably has some kind of, deep-seated spirits that are in there. I think the evil, whatever it was, it's still there.
Yeah, and the feeling that maybe what happened is still there as well with people. They know that it happened, and they know that this case was unsolved, and they know it was so horrific and so bad that it's on the back of your mind at every moment when you're on that farm. I actually went out there and I toured the place 10 years ago, and I remember walking to the second floor of the barn there, and I'm looking around, and I heard someone in a distance away, and it about scared me half to death. It was a real person that was living nearby. But it's that feeling when you're out there that there is something greater there, that there's a presence out there. That's always in the background when you're on that property. And I think it is the fact that, the 140th anniversary of the murders is coming up in March. I think that that really controls things out there, that people are so aware of it. And that, you know, up into the 1980s, they brought psychics out there to the property trying to communicate with this family, and the psychic said that she could. Who knows if mm-hmm. that was true or not. But they would also bring people out to search for gold. The Stelson Reed family, the murdered family, was, you know, always was rumored to have this gold and this money, and there's maybe a rumor that they buried the gold on the property as a hiding place, and the murderer never actually got it. So people would come out and search for gold, and that, you know, happened up into the 1980s. People are still searching for that stuff. That's at least been reported, and so that exists to this day. And the man who owns the property, his distant relatives are actually one of his relatives. Distantly was arrested for the case. So a lot of the same people still live in the area. And he even had some of the ghost hunter folks out there not too long ago. And he told me one of the men who came out there was trying to, you know, find ghosts, and they're trying to communicate with these people. And he, after he left, he had called the owner of the property and he said, "I will never return." Wow. He felt that something, he broke his leg after I was out there, and many of the investigators of the case had their legs broken when they were trying to investigate the case.
Kind of, have you physically been out there?
I have, yes.
Has anything happened to you?
Nothing has happened to me, but I am
knock on wood.
Step. I am very concerned. I'm very worried.
Are you really?
Well, it gets in your head. It is in the back of your mind. It's, but when you sit down and write a chapter like cursed that these things happen, you start seeing the patterns.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And then you start interviewing all the people, and it does stick in your back.
You see a pattern.
Yeah, you can't possibly not think about it. Now, do I think some evil, terrible thing is going to befall me? Not necessarily, but you think about it.
Yeah. You better surround yourself in light, that's for sure. The five people who were murdered, they were scattered all over the place.
Yeah.
To me, can one person do that with an axe, or do you think it's more than one?
Well, the theory based on the investigators, the sheriff who investigated the case, he was a politician. He was more concerned with solving it immediately and just declaring it closed. And that's what he was trying to do. But the other people, the coroner and the other people that were involved, you know, were all sort of going against his theory. He arrived there, you know, hours after the murders occurred. And he declared that it was one killer, but then all the other investigators started saying, no, it had to be two, because there was an axe involved, but there was also a thing called a corn knife. And the murderer not only cleaved and chopped all them up with an axe, but used a corn knife to finish them off with their necks. And that's really somebody who wanted to destroy them completely and totally. And they all believe that it had to be more than one person, because that's a lot of work. That's a lot of ground to cover in the dark night, in a dark house, without really awakening everybody and without doing it. You really need more than one person to do something like that. And so I think to this day, the idea is that it was more than one person.
The rage, the evil must be absolutely unbelievable.
It was. And that's why, you know, when you see a headline like demonism, or that something like that was a factor in it, you also think it wasn't just someone who was passing through and decided to kill an entire family, but it was someone who was really in what you called it, like a rage, or really hated this family. And this
Yes.
family was having feuds with people, but someone who was so consumed by that they not only killed this family, but they mutilated them, that they chopped them up so badly, you know, that, you know, they were missing body parts,
Yeah.
that, you know, that you couldn't recognize many of them.
They couldn't stop.
And they couldn't stop. Blood was spattered all over the walls. Blood was everywhere. It was congealed. And by the time they walked in the house, I mean, the place was covered in blood, because you got five victims there. So there's a lot of different victims. And so that's really, the killer was in a terrible, terrible frenzy.
Let's take a few calls here for you before the break. Then we'll wrap things up when we come back. Chris is in Columbus, Ohio, first-time caller. Chris, you're on with Nick Pfister. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Your guest just actually touched on something I wanted to say about the missing gold or what have you.
Yeah, go ahead.
But I grew up in German territory here in Ohio, in Wapakoneta and New Bremen, Ohio. And those old German farmers are very superstitious, to the point that they still paint like anti-hex symbols on the barns. And any good German family would have probably buried, you know, whatever gold they may have found with the bodies. And that would explain the unmarked graves and why the farmers wouldn't let them move it.
What are your thoughts on that, Nick?
I think that's an excellent point. That was never particularly mentioned in any of the news reports about the bodies. Some of the folks I interviewed had indicated that was a driving factor in some of the farmers not wanting those bodies moved. But another factor that they were concerned about early on was that this case was never solved, and that somehow, some ways, the bodies were still needed there in Sacktown before they could be moved. But people back then, they really didn't like moving the bodies. They felt like that you're disturbing the dead, and they were dead set on it. But I think the caller makes a very good point.
In your book, you talk about German immigrant farmers. They lived with extreme superstitions. What were some of them?
Well, as an example, the man who found the bodies, he actually arrived at the scene. He was concerned that he needed to plant his potatoes and get all of his crops planted before St. Patrick's Day. He actually was after St. Patrick's Day because it was a rainy season. So he felt that something bad was going to happen. He felt he was going to have a terrible crop, and because he was way past the superstition like that was that it had to be done, you know, sometime before St. Patrick's Day. So he arrived there on March 19th, and he opened up and found five bodies. Those were the type of superstition. These people were, you know, they were concerned about witches. They were concerned about all sorts of things that we don't even, you know, generally isn't as accepted today. But back then, those things were common. If you look at a lot of the newspapers from back then, they were filled with talk of spiritualism and many things going into that territory, which today is not really talked about at all.
No, not at all. Next up, we go to Dennis in Philadelphia. Dennis, you're on with us.
Good morning, yes.
Good morning, Dennis.
Hi, when your guest was speaking about how years later, some people were unable to live in the home.
Yes.
You know, this is really, really significant that, you know, when it comes to spirits and hauntings and that so forth, because this also happened to my mom. They were living in a house which also a family was murdered in. They didn't know this. And before my mom passed, she told me about this. My aunt had told me about this. And then my uncle also told me about this, how each night, first there was a white figure that was coming in the bedroom. Then the next night it was two figures. Then the next night there was two smaller figures, which were the children. And they would get the saint, hold it up in the air, scratch it, and paw at it. And then, of course, you know, all people are laughing at you and so forth. And while they were in the living room, telling my grandfather that, you know, we have to get out of here, my uncle was attempting to go up the steps to go to the bathroom. And lo and behold, on the top of the steps was, again, the family, all in white, looking down at my uncle. And then they left right away. They moved. And then years later, 40, 50, even going up until the 1990s, no family was able to live in that house. People constantly come and go. So what happens is that not only does the murder leave an imprint in that house, but also all the negative energy leaves an imprint. And on top of this, all the people that were taken before their time leave an imprint in that house. And that house is not able to be, the house becomes uninhabitable by whomever lives in there. Now, whomever moves in there, some people might have more activity, more severe activity than others. But nevertheless, there is going to be some sort of activity in that house.
Well, that's a good point. And, you know, Nick, has anybody ever thought of bringing out an exorcist to the property?
You know, that was never done in this case. I mean, exorcisms normally deal with
an individual
yeah. possessed. Yeah. But I know there are cases where exorcists have actually gone into properties and things like
that. Nick, we're going to come back and wrap things up with you and take final phone calls. Nick Pister with us. He writes for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, his book, The Axe Murders of Sacktown. Our internet-based television show is called Beyond Belief, and we deal with many of the things that we deal with here on Coast to Coast, except you can also see these people. So simply go to that website, beyondbelief.com, 10 days free. Take a look at as many shows as you can, beyondbelief.com. Welcome back. Final segment with Nicholas Pister and the Axe Murders of Sacktown. Nick, when you're writing the book, was there anything there that was puzzling for you, concerned you when you were putting it together?
Well, like I said, the case file had been stolen in the 1890s. It feels like someone was just really attempting to make sure that no one ever
found
wrote
out
about
anything.
This or did anything. But I was able, like I talked about my German language translator, really to get into some of those articles. It had a lot of details that the English language press didn't, really helped bring this to life. I also had to do extensive ancestry work, that sort of thing, to really kind of figure out who these people were, where they came from, trying to track who knew each other in the community, who may have, gotten together to try to commit this murder. One troubling issue was that one of the suspects in the case, I could not find where he went after the murder. He had received some inheritance from the estate after taking it to court, and then he vanished. I could not find out where he went. I was looking and looking and looking. I could not find him anywhere. Finally, I was able to track him to Nebraska. He had slightly changed the spelling of his last name, so he wasn't coming up in any of the searches I was doing. And he created a new life for himself, and he got out of town. He was never seen in the St. Louis area again.
Do you find that strange?
I did, and he was one of the major suspects, and you read about how he acted at the inquest. He refused to look at the bodies. He was shaking. He was convulsing. He was sweating. They stripped him, though, to see if he was wounded. They believed the killer of this family had been wounded. He had not a mark on his body, but one of the theories was that he possibly had paid someone else. A grubber is what they thought maybe is the person who had done this killing, because a grubber, as we call him, is basically somebody who could remove tree stumps and things like that. Germans were very particular about the land that the Irish would go on the lower lying areas like that were near water. The Germans liked to grow to get land that grew the best trees, and so therefore their land had a lot of tree stumps that needed to be uprooted, and therefore the guys out on these farms were very good at swinging an axe from both directions.
Like Paul Bunyan, weren't they?
Yes, and so that, the person who did this work was very good with an axe, as the crime scene description is. And so the theory is that it was possibly paid for. People from all this idea, years after the murders, there were these deathbed confessions that you would find people confessing to things. There was a man who committed suicide in Memphis who had sent a note to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, actually, or to another man and who sent us the Post-Dispatch saying that he did this crime, but that was discounted. That happened over and over out there. In fact, one investigator actually went and slept underneath the crawl space of a dying suspect's bedroom, thinking he would confess on his deathbed or talk in his sleep.
Unbelievable. But do you think, based on how these murders occurred, that this was premeditated, planned? Somebody went over there with the intent to kill them. It wasn't a person who, let's say, was a guest in the house and something happened.
Yeah, no, this was clearly premeditated by, if you look at it, by all indications that this family was targeted, and everyone agreed on that early. This family was targeted. Somebody wanted them dead. They wanted none of them alive. They went to such pains to make sure, a corn knife slit everyone's throat. They wanted to make sure no one was breathing in that house when they left.
Well, they got their wishes, didn't they?
They did.
Let's go to Gary in El Paso, Texas, on the wild card line. Hi, Gary. Good morning.
Good morning, George. Well, I grew up in South Dakota, and there was a family, the Iron Hawk family, Native Americans, and they one of the brothers chopped up his two brothers over a bottle of wine.
Oh, my God.
And to this day, well, at least 15 years ago, the house was still erect, kind of battered and torn up and almost falling down. But you could still, if you walk by the house, you can hear somebody coughing.
It's still out there, yeah.
It was a strange thing. But they put the brother in a mental health institution, and 20 years later, he was out, so.
You know what, Nick, have you come across other murders like this in your career?
Well, nothing like this. I mean, certainly nothing modern. I covered a case of a bodyguard for Joyce Meyer, the televangelist, who strangled his entire family. And he was convicted of that a few years ago. That's, you know, the closest sort of impact and something that really affected people. I've never seen, you know, just because he was someone who was a member of the family who killed his entire family. It's rare to see someone go into a house and kill everyone.
It sure is, especially with that kind of rage.
Yes. I mean, it's rare to just see somebody who wants to wipe out, you know, the children, the wife. And that's why they really came down to really thinking that it was someone who felt that they were going to inherit something. It wasn't just the rumors that this family had a gold stash or a cash stash or somewhere.
Yeah, somebody needed to get rid of heirs who would get money, right?
Right. And they actually even were going to the point, and the science was not there to do this. They were trying to see who died last, because that would have decided which side of this family the inheritance would have gone. So the theory would have been, while the killer was at work killing each person in the body, the inheritance was passing to the person in the room who was still alive.
To the next one,
yeah.
Exactly.
Whoever was killed last, conceivably by Illinois law at the time, that they would have been the person who had the estate then, because it was flowing to them, and whoever their direct in-law was would have gotten it.
How much money was involved in this in terms of, you know, what would have been passed down? Do we know?
The amount of gold, if it ever even existed, is unknown. The family's estate ended up being about $18,000.
Which was good money then, right?
Good money then. And, again, the United States was in an awful economic time. It was right after the Civil War. The overbuilding of the railroads had really culminated in what they called the Long Depression, and that was just setting in. People were doing anything for money. You had Civil War veterans who were out there doing backbreaking labor, trying to find any way to make a buck. And you could see how people would perhaps really be looking to steal money, but you couldn't possibly see why somebody would do this to get it.
Next up, we go to Frank, truck driving in Sacramento, California. Frank, go ahead.
Yes, you know, we had a terrible, terrible vision back in, or we saw something back in 57, 58 in Sacramento, California. And you know, even now when I tell my brother about it, he says, don't say anything to anybody. We don't think we're crazy. But anyway, what we saw, the three of us, my two brothers and myself, we saw the head of the devil. And to this day, I remember like it was yesterday. And that was, over 50 years ago.
Jeez, the head of the devil. Now, let's talk for a moment, Nicholas, about demons. What have you learned about demons covering the St. Louis exorcism case, knowing Father Cleary, writing this book on the axe murders? What have you learned about demons?
Well, you know, Father Cleary is very specific in demonic Christianity in this. This, you know, idea that, you know, for like the St. Louis exorcism case, the young boy would have brandings on his body, and at one point there was the Roman numeral X, and they believed that he had like 10 different demons who were inside of him. That's what at least the Christian mythology was around it. A lot of the Catholic teaching around demonology really goes back to this idea of Satan being alive in our time, that he's still his. These demons are essentially fallen angels, and that, you know, they're here to perform evil. And the mythology around that is what I, you know, learned a lot about. I'm not a theologian or anything like that, but that played into this case of the exorcism, because they believe that the young boy was possessed by something that was a demon, and that X on him was some sort of embodiment of mm-hmm. it. He had, you know...
He was fine afterward.
He was fine afterwards, and before, you know, there would be this diabolical laughter they would hear from him, or he would speak in languages that he shouldn't have known, or things like that that would make someone think that this isn't a normal situation. In fact, there was a Jesuit priest who was walking by Verhagen Hall, where one of the priests was doing his daily prayers, and he would constantly hear diabolical laughter in the background, and it turned out that it was the young boy. That really haunted that university for a period of time, and it's something that people still talk about today constantly.
Okay, let's go to Mike, truck driving in St. Louis. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, George, I had a question. I was reading on the internet about the axe murder in St. Louis, and I came across one in Iowa. I guess it was Villisca, Iowa, to where a guy walked in with an axe, hit his own axe, and killed 8 people.
Oh, geez. Yeah. You heard about that?
Yeah, I have. It was called the Villisca Axe Murders in Iowa. It happened in early 20th century, in about 1911 or 1912, and it was a family of, I believe, 4 children and the parents that were brutally murdered. There was an investigation that ensued. I don't remember if that case was ever solved, but that was on par. You know, this case, the Iowa case, is actually better known than this one in St. Louis, but I think the St. Louis one hopefully will start rivaling that, because it's just so fascinating with the curses, the legends, the ghosts, the different theories and the superstitions that surround it.
Okay, thank you, Mike. Appreciate your call. Nicholas, take a moment and tell us about your book and where people can get it and your website.
Yeah, it is. It's the title's Axe Murder, The Axe Murders of Saxtown. You can get it. It's available in bookstores across the country. It's available online at most major book sale outlets. My website is www.nickpistor.com.
Is this a possible movie?
You know, I think my phone is open if anyone's interested. I think it certainly has the makings for it. The one thing that holds it back is that it was not solved. But one thing that we don't have enough of, George, is mystery in the world anymore. You know, a lot of these crimes that happen today, they're solved so quickly, and they don't really have much intrigue. But this case really has a lot of mystery. It has a lot of suspicion. And it's a new case that people don't really hear about, don't know about, but it's something that people can really learn about and study and even discover something about themselves. I learned so much about German immigration and German history and how the country formed, how St. Louis formed in the early part of its existence from this. So there's a lot to tell and there's a lot to learn from it. And there's so many stories that we keep rehashing, whether it's the JFK assassination or whether it's conspiracy theories around things like that, or Lizzie Borden, or Jack the Ripper. This was the precursor to Jack the Ripper. This is the first real slaughter. But this was also before Sherlock Holmes and a lot of the murder mysteries that became so popularized.
Was this before Lizzie Borden?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Do you know Charlie Bosworth Jr. at all?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I do.
Good friend, good guy. Wrote the book on Who Killed JonBenet Ramsey.
Yes, he did.
With Cyril Wecht, the pathologist. And, the Post-Dispatch has created some great investigative reporters.
Yeah.
And there you are. So you're in fine company out there.
And Charlie is one of the finest. Charlie is a fine man, and he's done some great work.
Well, you tell him hi for me, too.
I will. It's like a reunion here.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it really is. We should have our little get-together when we get out there.
Yeah.
Where does a story like the Axe Murders of Saxtown, where does it go next? Because I got to believe it's creating a little stir, and that the people of that region who kind of kept it quiet, they're seeing this national publicity now.
Yeah.
And it's only going to get bigger. Where does this story go?
Well, I would like to see a couple of things. I would like to see, the case file of this had been stolen. I'm sure there are documents out there that I don't know about, that I could never know about, unless I really brought the publicity here. And hopefully now it's done that. You know, it's been in all the local papers. It's been around. People are talking about it. They're interested in it. It's a fascinating case. I would like to, just try to put together even more information. I wish someone who maybe had some documents or letters or anything to add to this would contact me or contact someone who could get that out there and really start help bringing this into the examination of it. That's one of the major things. But also that people really just get to learn this case and put it up there with some of the big cases that already exist on the lexicon of murder mysteries throughout the United States.
Well, let's go to Ronald in Sacramento, California. Hey, Ron, go ahead.
Hey, I just had you guys were talking about the axe murders and everything, and I was wondering what you were thinking about the Lizzie Borden case, as I had heard him comment on it.
As we know, Lizzie was not convicted, and you know, when I was a kid, I thought she was, but she never was, says Nick.
No, and you know, the thing about people always ask me, that's come up since this book has come out, you know, why I did some calls on a local radio show and people were asking, you know, why don't we know about this case, the axe murders of Axtown? But you know, they were talking about Lizzie Borden. She killed her mother and stepmother, or her father and stepmother, with an axe. Why is that so well known? And I think that, you know, that case involved a woman. It was in Boston, and it, you know, sometimes the timing of these things, you know, have some sort of factor in it. It happened in 1892. You know, I think that added to the intrigue in a case like that. But the Lizzie Borden case is also a fascinating one, and I think the thing that had going for it was there was a massive trial that you talk about that took place, and that she was acquitted, because, you know, very rarely do people ever get acquitted in this country.
And then they had that little silly poem that went out about her. Remember that as a kid?
I forget the exact words, but something about
Lizzie Borden took an axe, gave her mother 40 whacks. When the job was nicely done, she gave her father 41.
That was a wonderful reading.
Thanks. It was a strange, strange case. I think there's a Lizzie Borden house, and it's still open.
Yes.
I think they give tours out there.
I think you were absolutely right, and I think that a lot of those ghost stories and stuff surround that as well.
What's the fascination, Nick, with the macabre?
My fascination with it is really just the mystery of it, you know, is the biggest thing that can happen in someone's life is for them to die. And then when somebody, you know, takes that into their own hands and becomes a killer, you know, those are the mysteries that really are the big ones. And I just find cases like that so interesting, particularly, you know, we're talking about the Lizzie Borden case, you know, that she's acquitted, that case is technically open. You know, it's the same way for the ex-murders of Saxton, because no one was ever caught, tried, or convicted.
Yeah, it sure was. Well, good luck with this book. I'm going to call you back in a couple minutes during the break. I want to give you some information on a story you might want to follow
Great.
Up on, okay?
Excellent.
And Nick, good luck with this. Great work, by the way. I mean, very, very thorough work.
Thank you, George. I enjoyed being on your show.
All right. We will be back in a moment. Open lines next on Coast to Coast AM. If you're ticked off with this NSA situation and grabbing your text messages, check in with us. If you know about curses, I want to talk about that as well, plus your calls on Coast to Coast AM.